88 to 91.
Radio 2.
40 years ago, the Rolling Stones proclaimed themselves the greatest rock and roll band in the world as they set out on an ambitious U.S. tour in support of their album, Let It Bleed.
The greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Rolling Stones!
The Rolling Stones go on stage, who knows what's going to happen.
The Stones hadn't performed in the U.S. for over 3 years due to drug charges and legal complications. So this tour was a chance to showcase their music to an eager audience.
Please allow me to introduce myself, why I'm a man of wear and tears.
It was made up as it went along in the sense that it really was improvisation. It was really living art.
The tour resulted in one of the most acclaimed live albums ever recorded, and a stunning film that showcased the Stones at their best.
Well, I had always thought it was Neverland.
Oh, New York City, you talk a lot. Let's have a look at you.
But the groundbreaking music was overshadowed by events that unfolded at a disastrous free concert staged by the Rolling Stones at Altamont in California, which has come to represent the death of the hippie era of peace and love.
Yeah, it was all chaos. Complete and utter chaos.
Everyone, Hell's Angels, everybody. Let's just keep ourselves together.
4 people died at that concert, including a man who was beaten and stabbed to death by members of the Hell's Angels, right in front of the stage during the Stones' performance.
There's 500,000 people, and the only recognized form of control is the Hell's Angels. Now you're asking for trouble, right?
Brothers and sisters, everybody just cool out.
Meredith just was chopped to death, you know?
We were not going to waltz to glory. We were gonna need to shed some blood to get into hippie heaven.
I'm Huey Morgan, and this is the story of that infamous Let It Bleed tour that has become part of rock and roll legend.
I was surprised that we got out of it all alive.
When the Stones began planning their tour in late 1969, they were in the middle of a legal battle with their manager, Alan Klein, and their funds were frozen. So their first task was to enlist Klein's nephew, Ron Schneider, as their business manager, to find a way to finance the tour.
The Stones at that time didn't have any money because my uncle had frozen everything in litigation. And they were actually hoping to do the tour because the tours are the only way at that time to basically generate cash revenue. Otherwise, you wait for the record companies, you owe them $1 million, and you wait for anybody else to be, it doesn't happen. So they were looking to the tour to generate cash for themselves, and so there was no money.
Here we go.
While Ron negotiated the financial deals, the band, including Brian Jones' replacement Mick Taylor, moved to Los Angeles in early October to begin rehearsals. The personal assistant was Georgia Bergman.
I went out to set up what would be our operational situation. We had a DuPont house, because I think it had formerly belonged to a DuPont, which was a big ranch house in the Hollywood Hills. The office was going to function out of there, and Charlie and Shirley stayed there. That was where everything kind of came and went, and Ronnie was there. And then for Mick and Keith and Mick Taylor, I had to find some place where they would be comfortable and out of the way, just so that they could have their privacy. And Stephen Stills let us rent his house, which was very nice of him. And they had their social life, let's say, there.
I had to put up.
Sam Cutler was the Stones' tour manager.
We were staying at Stills' house up in the top of the canyon, which was a beautiful house, lovely kind of California-style house, up in the woods, the top of Laurel Canyon, endless beautiful girls climbing over the fences and coming by, swimming pool, everybody lounging around, roaring log fire. It was lovely. The rehearsals happened in the wine cellar. Yeah, they were pretty ragged, I tell you. I mean, the Rolling Stones, people don't realise it. They're what I call a pressure band. I mean, their rehearsals, man, were just dilatory. I mean, just shocking. Pathetic, man. I mean, nice to hear, but, you know, really all over the place. And then we got a soundstage in Burbank at Warner Brothers lot there, the soundstage from the film They Shoot Horses, Don't They? So it was a big kind of Chinese ballroom, massive, and set the stage up that we were going to use on tour. Then they rehearsed there, and that was also all over the place. And it was only like in the last 2 days that it kind of vaguely came together. The Rolling Stones aren't like the Eagles. Eagles go on stage, everything's note perfect, it's kind of almost robotic. The Rolling Stones go on stage, who knows what's going to happen? Keith could fall over. Who knows what? You get that kind of human feeling with them. There's a struggle going on to make it work. And I think that's one of the reasons they're so successful. There's a certain kind of arrogance in the Rolling Stones.
Because the band had booked large venues, they decided to bring in Chip Monk, who had been the production manager at Woodstock, to add some drama and theatrics to the stage show.
I sat down with Mick and I suggested that we not do it in the dining room where everybody was congregating and doing all sorts of stuff. That we only go out near the pool where the grass is nice, and we'll all sit on the grass and discuss it. And of course, the wind comes up and all the plans get blown away. And he said, "Oh, just do it."
During those weeks in L.A., the Stones went in the studio to complete tracks for the Let It Bleed album, even though they didn't have relevant work permits.
You needed a separate visa to do live gigs or recording. So their visas were for their tour, but there weren't visas that covered them being able to record. That was a distinction that was lost on the Rolling Stones. They didn't even toss about that.
Mick Jagger was not only focused on the band's music, but he was also very aware of the business deals Ron was putting together for the tour.
Well, we all need someone we can lean on.
Mick went to the London School of Economics, and I think one of the other reasons why they're the most successful band that you still sing around is because of his attitude towards reality and money.
Yeah, we all need.
Mick did care about the bottom line, but behind it he had talent, and he had Keith Richards and an entire group. The Rolling Stones, as far as I see that, they always considered it was a business.
Where you can lean on me.
Mick was very interesting because when he did The Office, he did The Office. He was the CEO. He was completely there and focused, and plans were made and so on, and just like anybody running a company. When he started recording, that's what he did. Didn't do The Office. Didn't do any of that stuff. If I wanted to talk to him or see him, I would go to Olympic and take whatever it was that needed to be attended to or signed or looked at, and usually fall asleep until they woke me up at 3 a.m. and said, "Okay, what is it you want?" When he was involved with recording, that's what he did. It wasn't 50-50. It was totally that.
Ten days before the tour was about to begin, the band held a media conference at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. Several of the journalists made mention of an article that had been written by influential rock journalist Ralph Gleason, which criticized the high price the Stones were charging for tickets.
There was a few kind of vaguely hostile questions, mainly about ticket prices. The Stones were charging $7.50. It makes you laugh to think about it now, $7.50 for ticket prices to their LA shows, which compared favourably, you know, with the Doors and people like that. But there was criticism of that, or implied criticism. A couple of kind of snide questions from Hollywood gossip columnists. But other than that, everyone was very friendly, you know. And Mick was in fine form.
In response to the criticism, Mick mentioned the possibility of the Stones performing a free concert.
Hey, babe, what's in your eyes?
That's when it first came out. Because it had been talked about in London. Rock Scully from the Grateful Dead had come over to London and talked to us prior to the Hyde Park concert. And Mick let the cat out of the bag. And once it was out of the bag, it was like, "Well, when are you going to do that free concert?" was a constant refrain.
A little more.
I think the Rolling Stones are very sensitive to the accusation that their ticket prices were like rip-off prices.
You got my soul. You got the silver. Got the gold.
And I think that played a part in their deciding to do the freak show. You know, they just saw the freak show as this kind of, you know, we were all naive as babies, you know. They just saw it as a kind of wonderful way of saying thank you to their devoted American fans.
There had been an earlier thing where Mick was saying that the tickets should be really cheap, like a dollar. And this was, of course, post-Woodstock. So it was something that was very much on everybody's mind, that this was the kind of tenor of the times and that we should consider that. I mean, we had a tour to do. So it was just, oh, yeah, okay, no, okay, fine. Take it into consideration, but we had to get a show together. And then later on, it started to become more of a reality.
The Let It Bleed tour officially began with a warm-up show in Fort Collins, Colorado on November 7th. And it was Sam's job to do the introduction.
When they were rehearsing, they were dreadful. I was looking at them thinking, if this is going to work, my name's Jaime Finkelstein, you know what I mean? It was just all over the place. And there were two gorgeous girls there in the hall where they shot, they shoot horses, don't they, where we were doing the final rehearsals. And I said, well, what do you think of this? And this girl said, oh, they're great. And I said, really? And she said, oh, yeah, they're the greatest rock and roll band in the world. And it just kind of registered with me. I didn't say anything. I just thought, yeah, really? You know what I mean? They certainly don't sound like it to me. And then we were flying to Colorado and everything was arranged and all that. And then Ronnie suddenly said, hey, you know what? We haven't got anyone to introduce the band. And Mick said, oh, well, Sam will do it. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. What the hell? So then I was taking care of business, as you do, and I didn't even think about it. And then 2 seconds to go, I've got to go on and introduce it. What am I going to say? And then this girl's comment, the greatest rock and roll band in the world, just popped into my head. So I ran on stage, you know, and did the whole bit.
For the first time in 3 years, the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Rolling Stones! The Rolling Stones!
Place went mental, off it went, and Mick was very unhappy. Afterwards, you said, I've got to talk to you. So we went on our own into a dressing room, and he said, don't call us the greatest rock and roll band in the world. So I just said to him, well, are you or are you not? And that was the end of that. And it stuck. I continued to use it ever since. And I did it because, you know, anyway, it was a kind of reverse psychology thing. You get out there and you call a band the greatest rock and roll band in the world. It's like, okay, now get your finger out and prove it.
The following night, they played the Forum in Los Angeles. Writer and journalist Michael Lydon was reporting on the tour for the New York Times.
This was a big, big deal for me and for a lot of people. When I told my friends that I was going on the Rolling Stones tour as part of the entourage, they were clearly green with envy. I knew that being on the tour, I was where every hippie wanted to be. The Stones were like an opening to this new hippie movement of drugs and pot and music and not thinking about your career and just living in the moment and all this stuff that was going on, tie-dye and bell-bottom jeans. Even in 1969, it was still something kids had a choice. So did they really want to jump over and become a hippie? Or no, was that too scary? The Rolling Stones rocked the box. That night, that show, from the Chuck Berry stuff at the beginning to the quiet stuff. You got to move. Keith would sit and play the National Steel guitar. Mick would sort of stand there in the spotlight and they'd do a blues. But then they built to that Midnight Rambler. Now, that was this sort of long, dramatic set piece. It was really theater. But they kept in touch with the music the whole time. That was a beautiful production. It built to such a climax. But Mick Jagger lifted back and took his belt and went slap on the stage. The place was just riveted.
To open the shows, the Stones booked several acts who had been very influential to them, including Chuck Berry, Ike and Tina Turner, and B.B. King.
Stones have always been very generous in a cultural influence sense. They've always thanked the people like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, all those kind of people that played a part in their musical evolution. They've always paid tribute to them.
Number one, the king of the blues, B.B. King.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I would like to dedicate this to the stars of the show, the Stones, because had it not been for them, you wouldn't have heard B.B. King.
The Stones have managed to take the black R&B music thing, if you like, and slightly evolve it and marry it to a kind of English rock sensibility, and they've produced some absolutely wonderful music as a result.
I think the Stones were consciously introducing their white American fans to these fabulous black musicians who had been such inspirations to the Stones.
The demand for tickets in some cities was so strong that the Stones did two shows a night, and the crowds were very enthusiastic. Ron Schneider.
My biggest concern was getting everybody out safely.
Thank you very much. We sure got it.
Because that was a time where we'd go to events and there'd be tear gas. We'd go to events and they'd turn over buses and cars. There'd be fires. There'd be a lot of violence on the campuses and all that.
Oh, you sure sound very pretty to us.
The minute they went to go on, my concern was making sure there was a fast and swift exit.
The band traveled between shows on a chartered jet, which gave them the freedom to create their own schedule, which one night included a detour to take in the delights of Las Vegas.
It was Mick, really, because Mick was like, Ronnie, how long have we got this plane for? Because we were in San Diego. And Ronnie said, well, we got it for 8-10 hours or whatever it was. And Mick was like, well, if we fly back to LA, that takes 20 minutes. You know, we paid for the plane. Let's go somewhere. So Mick and Keith immediately, you know, a little put their heads together. That took 2 seconds. Yeah, let's go to Vegas. Ronnie said to the pilot, you know, can we fly this to Vegas? Sure, you can fly it anywhere. You know what I mean? You paid for it. Let's go to Vegas. So off we went, you know. So that was great fun. It's been all ahead
and family come in the land. And there were some iCats along for the ride. And just the touring party. Ronnie would have collected the cash from the house. And he would have it in a suitcase chained to his wrist, usually. And in Las Vegas, people needed some spending money. So Ronnie helped out.
I was picking up the overages at the concert.
Ron Schneider.
There we're talking about 25 to 40,000, and this is 1969 dollars. Well, a man said, I'll give you a job. Which were a billion in current dollars. But there was a lot of cash, and I used to just put it in a briefcase. And at the time, all of a sudden, the police came to me and they said, oh, we've gotten word that the Black Panthers are going to try and rip off this money. And with that, they said, hold it. And they basically handcuffed me to my briefcase. And I said immediately, wait a second, I didn't want to be handcuffed to my briefcase. Money isn't worth losing my hand or my arm over. So I was very upset with that. We had to change that. But they did legitimately briefcase handcuff me. But then as one little aside I'll give to that story is Ike from Ike and Tina. Ike Turner came over to me and said, I got word that the Black Panthers are coming after you to try and take the money to use for their institution. And I said, yeah. He says, come here, Ron. And he pulls me into the corner he said, all of us are carrying, you stay around us, we'll take care of you. And he opened up his jacket and he had a 45. So I felt pretty good and safe.
Ike Turner wasn't the only member of the tour party carrying a gun.
America, mate. Everybody's got guns in America, you know what I mean?
If you're sitting in a hotel room in Sacramento, California, and you hear a bing and a bullet goes through the floor, you see it drive through, and on the other side of the room is Keith Richards checking out his Derringer that he wanted to see if it worked, you understand that, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities of not dying a normal death. You got to accept it.
Excessive use of cocaine is notoriously a producer of paranoia. So everybody gets edgy and paranoid and stuff. But there was guns everywhere.
And it wasn't just cocaine in plentiful supply on the tour.
I mean, there was certainly grass and hash and coke, but it didn't feel unusual. It just felt like you did what you needed to do to kind of get up.
It was a cocaine tour. It was complete lunacy. There was a guy who sat in a room in a hotel, you know, with a giant bag of cocaine. I mean, giant, a couple of kilos. If you wanted it, you just took a 35mm film can and gave it to him, and he filled it up and gave it back to you. So I spent a considerable amount of time running up and down filling up film cans. So it all went somewhere. It wasn't paid for by the Rolling Stones, I can assure you.
Of course, any rock and roll tour in 1969 was expected to have sex to accompany the drugs.
Those were the days of groupies. That was their career. The Butter Queen literally turning up with a pound of butter. I mean, they knew where we were before we did. There were certain girls just turning up, and they were legendary because Rolling Stone wrote about them, and it was a societal norm, as it were, for rock tours.
Around the Rolling Stones, well, you know, the most seductive, most beautiful, most attractive, exquisite creatures that one could possibly dream of, who were quite prepared to do anything. I mean, if that's not one version of heaven, I don't know what is.
As the tour rolled on, the lifestyle became more excessive.
There's a thing that happens on rock and roll tours. You're isolated from the world, you're in your own bubble, and it only has to do with what time do you have to get up, when are you going to eat, and can you get your laundry done? Those are the critical points. That didn't happen on this tour. It was wild and woolly.
By the time the band reached New York on November 27th, media attention was at its peak.
Les Perrin, who was our publicist, called me and said, I think you better let Mick know that the press are going to be calling him because Marianne Faithfull has left him and decamped with this Italian. So they want to, going to want to quote. This was a total shock. So add that to everything else with the performances and Hendrix and Leonard Bernstein arriving and Janis was there. So it was nonstop madness.
Those New York concerts are still regarded as some of the best live shows of the decade and were recorded for the classic Get Your Ya-Ya's Out album and also featured in the film Gimme Shelter, directed by Albert Maysles.
The Stones at that point, they came full blossom at Madison Square Garden, and they haven't diminished since. Fabulous performances. If it's going to be real, then it can't really be planned. You could have tentative plans, but you have to be ready to break them for something better that'll come up on its own. What Orson Welles described as divine accidents.
In New York, the press once again mentioned Ralph Gleason's article and the subject of the free concert.
I read in one of the papers that you'll be giving a free concert in San Francisco.
We are doing a free concert in San Francisco.
When?
On December 6th. And the location is not Golden Gate Park, unfortunately, but it's somewhere adjacent to it, which is a bit larger.
I could actually say honestly that Ralph Gleason caused Altamont. Once again, it was a case of the press basically instigating things that there never needed to be. The article's totally false. The Stones were doing something to present a beautiful musical experience. And for that, we were getting punished by people like Ralph Gleason coming out and saying, oh, they're ripping everybody off. The Stones love their fans. Why else do they do it? And because of the lies in Ralph Gleason's article, the Stones thought they had to do a free concert to help everybody out. They got caught up, as everybody else did, with this, oh no, we got to make it up to our fans with this article. So that's how the free concert came about. And as far as I'm concerned, it was his article that caused this thing. I always get concerned by that thing which is no good deed goes unpunished. And I was always concerned that the punishment was his free concert, as it turned out to be. What if somebody said, wait, I paid for this show and I was, you know, in Baltimore, and why are you doing a free concert out in Oakland? Why, you know, I just thought it wasn't fair to the other fans, but gee, I was overruled.
I saw her today at the reception.
After the New York shows, the Stones and their entourage flew to Baltimore on two private jets.
So there we are, flying in formation to Baltimore. And it was kind of waving at each other almost on two Learjets. This is nuts, because you just had this idea somewhere in the back of your mind. This probably costs a lot of money.
We thought we'd break the Guinness Book of World Records and be the first people to moon one another. The Rolling Stones did it, very rock and roll, and I'm proud to say I participated.
I don't know that I recollect that there was actual mooning going, but there might have been from the other plane, because I might have been on the one that was being mooned. That was two kids in very expensive aircraft. We're all crazy now. Definitely a good example of Peter Pan and the Lost Boys. Although I'm always wondering who was Captain Hook.
After the tour's final gig in Florida on November the 30th, the Stones went down to Muscle Shoals Studios in Alabama to record some more sessions, once again illegally, while the rest of the crew headed to San Francisco to work on plans for the free concert, scheduled for December the 6th. Michael Lydon.
The whole reason for Altamont began with show business, but also sincere on Mick Jagger's part, to sort of say thank you, San Francisco. The San Francisco whole hippie thing really was affecting music. And the brother and sister spirit of the hippie thing was real, and they responded to it. And then they got in touch with the Grateful Dead, and the Grateful Dead, they're the right people. Woodstock was all love and peace. It hadn't become violent. So now this was going to be the next concert. What was going to happen? How could it be bigger? How could it be better? So right from the beginning, there's this big weighted expectation.
By the time I got to San Francisco, which was only a few days in front of the actual concert, the atmosphere was hysterical, is the only word I can use. Total media frenzy. The radio was going, stay posted, listen to this, you know, it's supposed to be at Sears Point, but there's been a problem with that site, but they're frantically looking for another site. This is KSAN in San Francisco, and stay tuned about the Rolling Stones free concert. And it just went on and on every radio station on the whole of the West Coast.
We were originally supposed to be doing Golden Gate Park, and Golden Gate Park, I was told, fell apart. And then all of a sudden I was told, please, Ron, get on a plane and fly in here and negotiate for Sears Point Raceway.
I went with Ronnie to the raceway to Sears Point and listened to this conversation with these people talking about just making astronomical demands, and was just like, you gotta be kidding. So that was crazy.
While the band recorded the tracks Brown Sugar and Wild Horses in Alabama, they were oblivious to all the drama unfolding in San Francisco.
Nobody had actually called the Stones, who were recording, to tell them anything. So I called Stu and said, it's getting goofy out here, and told him just generally they were trying to sort something out and trying to move it and et cetera. At that point, it was the show must go on. Reason be damned. And they felt that they were superhuman, and they felt that we can do this.
They came up with this site. And I was at the Grateful Dead's office. I was called, and they said, yeah, we want someone from the Rolling Stones to check the site out. Well, Ronnie couldn't do that. He was staying on top of all the lawyers and the mafia. So three people went in a helicopter. I sent them in a helicopter, Rock Scully, Chipmunk, and Michael Lang, who's the producer of Woodstock. They went, saw the site, came back to me and said, yeah, it can be done. So that was good, right? And then all of a sudden, all the airwaves on Wednesday or Thursday before the Saturday of the show going, it's going to be at a place called Altamont. It's at the Altamont Speedway, blah, 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 blah. And I arrived there on the Friday, and it was absolute. I couldn't believe that this is where we were going to play. It was a shocking place. The world's worst place to put on a rock and roll show. They said yes to it because of the pressures that were on everyone to kind of say yes. No one had the balls to stand up and say, no, this can't be done. Childhood.
stage was already being built at the Sears Point Raceway when negotiations for the use of the site broke down, so there was less than 48 hours to find an alternative. Production manager Chip Monk.
Here I am with a 1 meter high stage with a lovely incline of about 25 degrees with the stage on top of the mound. And then all of a sudden we're transported because of a financial condition to Altamont, where I now have a bowl and I've got a 1 meter stage and some chain link. I've got some scaffold towers for follow spots that never got put up, and the kids all tore the boxes apart because they were wooden boxes and burned them because they were cold, which left 12 $6,000 units sitting in the mud.
The actual physical location of that stage was, in my opinion, one of the major reasons why we had so much trouble. It was only less than a meter high. They put it in the bottom of a valley, so it would be surrounded by 300,000 people. It came up to people's knees.
Because the filming in New York had gone so well, the Maisels brothers were invited to film at Altamont as well. Albert Maisels.
All of this happened within 24 hours. We didn't know that it was going to take place until very shortly before it happened. And so we had to call up on friends and people like, for example, George Lucas, whom we never had met. And fortunately, he was free and was quite happy to come along.
The concert was receiving lots of media exposure, and Eamon McCabe was one of the thousands of students in San Francisco at the time determined to attend the show.
So we hear this great concert on, and then every day it's getting better. You know, the people in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Jefferson Airplane. On the airwaves, you hear things like, well, the Hells Angels are going to police the thing. You know, let's be cool out there. Let's not cause any trouble. Half of San Francisco must have gone out there. Wow. 300,000 people in this kind of natural bowl. If you imagine, Brands Hatch might be a natural bowl because of the way the track goes and whatever. So it seemed a good place to do it.
On the night before the concert, Mick and Keith traveled out to the site with Sam and Ron.
The night before we arrived was fantastic. It was like magic where you see you're walking in the dark and there's little campfires and the construction's going on in one area and you see just huddles of little people sipping wine, smoking joints. Very quiet, very peaceful, and we'd walk over to a little gathering, and by we, I mean it was myself, Mick and Keith. We'd go over to this group of people and they'd pass the big bottle of wine and, you know, chug it, and we're talking, you know, big gallon jugs of wine, and we'd chug a little of that, smoke a little pot, and then walk on. We came to this one site, said hello to everybody, smiled, very quiet, nobody says a word, and then we started to walk away. And as we're walking, I'm talking to Mick and Keith, and we're walking and looking, and all of a sudden I look behind us, and basically there was just this long line of people silently walking, just following us, but nobody saying a word, nobody ruining the moment. It was just really spectacular. Then we realized that when we were going to go back, Keith said, you know, it's so nice here, I don't want to leave. I'm going to stay. So Keith spent the night.
Within a few hours, the mood of the crowd had changed dramatically. Albert Maisels.
We came to a fence, which somebody broke down for us to easily get by. And Keith made the comment, first act of violence. And so that was an incredible premonition of what was to come.
Sam Cutler.
I went around at 2 o'clock in the morning on the Friday night before the Saturday show, man, and it was just like unbelievable. It was 150, 200,000 people camping. Every barn and fence post for miles around had been pulled down and put on blazing fires. There were people having sex everywhere, you know, openly, and just mad people running around naked with this kind of crazy look in their eyes, and just a very bad scene. It was not good, not good at all.
Santana was the first band on stage, followed by Jefferson Airplane, the Flying Burrito Brothers, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. By the time the Stones arrived on the site, the atmosphere in the crowd had become very threatening. Ron Schneider.
The next day when we flew in by helicopter to give you once again the attitude of the crowd, the security guy in the blue security suit came out, this young guy. And we said, where do we go? He says, follow me. And he starts taking us right into the middle of the crowd. And as we're being surrounded, all of a sudden, I hear noise, the boom, and the guy's pinned on the car, and I realize this guy, a fan, had punched Mick. And Mick's, don't hurt him. And I'm the opposite thing. I believe violence begets violence. And everybody else was jumping on, but Mick was, no, be cool. And he kept it calm at that moment. But he did get punched in the mouth. And that, to me, set the tone of the balance of the day.
Georgia Bergman.
As soon as we got off the helicopter, somebody punched Mick. So that didn't seem friendly. This was just a place where people were in a bad way before anything happened. So I just thought the audience was trouble. That audience was not friendly, receptive. It was not an enjoyable place to be.
Everyone in the Stones' entourage was completely shocked at the atmosphere, because they were expecting the peace and love they'd experienced in the free concert in London in July.
We had been in Hyde Park, which was wonderful, just delightful, and a sunny day, and even though Brian had just died, it was a splendid day.
The Hells Angels had been on hand that day in London. Someone has also suggested that they attend the Altamont show. No one objected. Chipmunk.
They thought the best security that they could think of was a truck, and fill that with beer. Add to that a bushel basket of pills. They all sat on the front of the stage, and they drove their cycles wherever they chose to put them. And if somebody was in the way, they either ran over them, or those people were smart enough to move aside.
Journalist Michael Lydon.
Young people at the time, they were thinking of the poet is outlawed, the outlaw is groovy, and then there was the Hell's Angels. They're really angels, but they're like, even though they're tough, they're really groovy, and they're the really existential He-Man or something like that. And they're our friends. But in fact, they were a bunch of thugs who would beat your head in for a nickel, who were all involved in the heavy, heavy drug trade and various criminal activities. Not nice. If they'd see a naive person, they would be like, it would be an invitation to them to, you know, I'll show you what life is like, and just beat the hell out of them. And they came into this place. They just were riding their motorcycles down this hillside that was already packed with people. And they basically, it was, get out of the way, get crushed. They were not going to stop for any reason. And then they parked their bikes down sort of the choicest area, and for the rest of the day were strutting around.
The Angels' presence added to the ill feeling Ron had about the concert.
When we arrived in the helicopter and I saw what was going on there, I said, make sure the helicopter doesn't leave. We got to have something when we get out here at night. Our security guy went over to the helicopter guy and he says, well, I don't fly at night. And with that, my guy says, I've got a gun that says you do. Basically pulled out his security gun so the helicopter stayed.
Thing is, it's just like everyone coming and having a good time. And the concert's not actually the proscenium of a theatre. It's like an excuse for everyone just to sort of, you know, get together and like talk to each other and sleep with each other and ball each other and get very stoned and just have a nice night out and a good day, you know.
Sam Cutler.
Not all of California were hippies in 1969, man. Hippies were still a very, very small minority. How can I bring you to this sea of madness? A lot of the kids that were at that show came from the peninsula, from San Jose, Sacramento, all kinds of rural towns in California that were footy playing, beer swilling, straight rednecks. There was this kind of bizarre combination of people, and then there was very, very bad drugs. There were hundreds of bad acid overdoses. And then the fact the Stones were playing, and it was just a kind of volatile, mad American mix. And you put 500,000 Americans together in a field, they don't know how to behave, mate.
As the atmosphere became worse, Sam tried to persuade the Stones to play in daylight.
I'd been sending them reports all day back to the hotel in San Francisco, telling them, hey, you guys, we've got to get out here. Let's play this in daylight and do it and go.
Eamon McCabe was at the front of the stage filming when the Hells Angels first started the violence.
I did notice the Hells Angels on the top of a bus, like a tourist bus on the right. And I remember it was sinister, you know. I didn't know what these guys were like. I mean, they were always very threatening. I'd been in a few queues in post offices where, because I had long hair and a beard, I got my ankles kicked by them. And so not a group that you take to. But my reading of it was, there was a huge guy in front of me. This happened in the afternoon when Jefferson Aeroplane were on, and he gradually stripped off to dance to the music. And they took real umbrage to the fact that this guy was dancing naked. I could see them coming, and it's hard to imagine, but if you're in the front of, I don't know, 300,000 people and something's kicking off, you've got nowhere to go. I was scared. I mean, I was 19. I'm no brave soldier, you know. See queues wielded in that fashion. Sun cuts loose from the frozen. It was awful stuff. Until it joins with the African sea. We're guilty of being frightened. We've just seen someone being beaten up with billiard cues. And I suppose any association with that guy would then lead to you to get beaten up. You know, why are you helping this guy? If you see a chapter of Angels on the move, you don't ask questions.
Jefferson Airplane singer Marty Balin was knocked out during a fight with the Hells Angel, and when the Grateful Dead arrived and witnessed the chaos, they refused to play and flew back out.
Well, they didn't play because as soon as they arrived, Mike Shreve, the drummer from Santana, told him, you know, that Marty had been knocked out and da-da-da-da-da and this had happened and that had happened, and they just went, oh, no, and they, you know, hung out for a bit and saw the vibe and just decided, no way, they weren't going to play. Not their scene. I mean, that was their choice. But, I mean, I thought it was an absolutely morally cowardly thing to do on their part. I mean, it was their people who'd initiated the free concert idea in the first place. It was organised out of their office. Then they didn't play. Cowards. Moral cowardice.
Once it was dark, Stones began their set. Eamon McCabe.
The Stones came on then in the evening, and he wanted to come on when it was dark, and he wanted to cause a stir. He wanted it to be satanic. Quite interesting if you look at the whole thing, the black cloak, the Omega sign on the shirt. It's all very satanic. And then it all kicks off again through several stages. And of course, it's nighttime now. Not as easy to see what's happening. Earlier in the afternoon, you can tell the wave coming from one side. You can tell people are clearing, you know, to, hey, look after yourself. But at nighttime, very tricky to know what's really going on. And obviously, we're all there to hear him sing Sympathy for the Devil, and this sort of music, which was the stuff at the time. And he starts it up, and it's wonderful, you know. And you're away, you're out in a huge field with 300,000 people. You're knocked out on the whole energy of it, the adrenaline of it.
When the Stones finally got on the stage, it's very hard to set. There was an atmosphere around the stage, and that atmosphere maybe went about 50 feet out around the stage, which was an atmosphere of death. I absolutely felt it. There was something in the air. A girl next to me got hit on the head by a full can of soda, blood gushing all over the place. You just felt evil in the air.
I was on the stage, and it was truly weird. Right from the start, the Stones were trying to cool the audience down.
Will you cool out, everybody?
I flew up, man.
I know.
There was sort of waves of energy go shooting across the audience in this sort of strange light. It was truly a hellish, hellish situation.
All right. How are we doing over there? Can we still make it down the front?
As the Stones were playing their classic Under My Thumb, another scuffle broke out directly in front of the stage. For some unknown reason, a young black guy, Meredith Hunter, drew a gun and was immediately attacked by several Hells Angels.
I went down and saw him lying on the ground, bleeding to death. And I went back to Mick and told him that he'd had a gun and everything. I mean, Mick was absolutely, he's got the balls of a lion. He was so courageous on that day, I take my hat off to him. I said, get off the stage right now, man. The guy's dead. I want you off the stage. And Mick said, no, 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 we've got to finish this. We've got to finish this.
And all of a sudden, while I was backstage looking for something, a call came to me saying, Ron, this guy's been stabbed. Where's the ambulance? And they thought we had set the ambulance about to use as part of our escape plan. You know, to get in the ambulance, zoom over to the helicopter and get out of there. So I knew we had the ambulance handy. So I ran over to the area where it was, but there was no driver. And that's when I started running around screaming, where's the driver? We got to get this guy's been stabbed. And there was a cop once again. People don't realize there were cops and security guys there. And the cop said to me, oh, you don't need to run anymore. He's dead. And that was like a punch in the stomach at the time.
Eamon McCabe was filming the Stones' performance in front of the stage.
You can tell in one or two bits he's shocked, and he's tiny. I remember him tiny, so tiny on this stage. Tiny man on a tiny stage in front of a huge audience. It's an interesting risk. You know, 300,000 people. I mean, if you're the big lead singer from Canned Heat, you can maybe think you can handle it. But I remember how fragile he was and how small he was.
Georgia and several others stayed backstage in a small caravan, affected by both the tension and the bad drugs.
Was not quite sure what had been dosed, and I just remember saying to somebody, because I started to feel a bit weird, please make sure I'm with you when we leave, because I may not be able to help that. So there was a phone in there. I just was making phone calls when we saw the ambulance come out. And I thought, well, I know that the Stones are leaving in an ambulance, but they can't be leaving now. And somebody said, somebody's been hurt. And the girlfriend was crying, and we could see all this and thinking, what the hell is going on here? And then Astrid came out, and a couple of suits said, we have to leave now. So Astrid and I climbed this hill with the suits to go to the helicopter and felt like it was just like Vietnam. I mean, it was the middle of the night, and it was dark, and it was weird, and we could hear the music, and then we could hear the music stopping and starting again.
As soon as they had finished their set, the band joined the rush for the helicopter.
I think it was built for 10, and we had 17 on it.
If you look at the video footage of the helicopters leaving Vietnam, it was about similar to that. I mean, everybody in the world was trying to jump in. They were all over me. People were laying across me and all this, and we're screaming, get out of here, get out of here. And the helicopter driver says, okay, slam the door, and we take off. And as he takes up, he says, okay, we have a problem, which is not what you want to hear from your pilot after you've taken off. I said, well, what is it? He said, we have too many people, we're way overweight, and we're not going to be able to land this normally because of the weight that we have. We're going to have to land this like an airplane. So I've never done it before, but I'm sure we'll be okay, but we're going to have to glide in and come in for landing that way as opposed to the hover down.
We were flying at an angle. I can't imagine that this pilot dared to lift off. It was spooky. I think it was about 20 minutes to this little airport in Tracy, and we got off the helicopter, and then we took a plane to San Francisco.
I think most of us were in shock from what had happened and the death and the beatings and all of the things that was going on around the stage and having to stop the show because of the violence. People really weren't talking. I remember going back to the hotel room and nobody said anything. Everybody was locked in their own little world for whatever it was, contemplating to their own selves what had just happened.
Ronnie and I went to the airport until 4 a.m, booking everybody on wherever they were going. Everybody had a different routing home, and Mick and I went to Geneva.
On that flight to Geneva, Mick took with him the tour takings in cash, in a bag.
Actually, it was a ball. It was a football. Had a zip on it. It was like a bag thing that was in the shape of a football. Geneva just was concerned that we had drugs, and they were looking at all my vitamin pills. And they wouldn't let Mick and I out of the airport for like 4 hours. We had to be searched. We didn't have any drugs. It's Switzerland. Do they care? That's their drug.
In addition to Meredith Hunter's murder, two people died in hit-and-run accidents and another drowned in a ditch. Back in San Francisco, no one could believe the disaster that had unfolded.
Oh,
journalist Michael Leiden.
It was really the love generation confronting hate. It was our attempts to be good meeting success at being evil. We didn't know what to make of it. It scared us. We were naive. We were not going to waltz to glory. We were going to need to shed some blood to get into hippie heaven.
Albert Mazels.
We didn't know for sure that we got it on film. So I stayed in Los Angeles several days. And when the footage was processed, I came across it. And I just had to look at it over and over and over again. It was so compelling.
While the band left immediately, several of their crew stayed behind and tried to sort out the mess. Sam Cutler.
The Stones left America and just left me to it. Thanks very much, friends. Never paid me. I was never paid for the whole tour.
Ron Schneider was even pursued by the Mafia for the money they believed they were owed.
At the end of the tour, I then had to go over to Europe and do the 1970 tour with the Stones. I come back, and I'm starting to get word that bills haven't been paid. Finally, one night, to my apartment comes these three guys, big guys, in suits. And it was them saying, okay, you got to write us a check, and we want 25% of the Rolling Stones. I knew for a fact, after watching all the movies I've watched, that as the accountant, eventually they'd kill me anyhow, because they'd be ripping each other off, and it'd be the accountant gets accused, and they'd kill me in cement shoes. So I immediately said, I can't do a deal with you. I can't work with you guys. They pulled their guns out. My wife was on the stairs with my baby. She was freaking out. They said, look, we'll just kill you. And I just said, well, you're going to kill me later anyhow, so whatever. And they said, oh, you're crazy. Well, you write us a check for $25,000 from your Stones account now. And I said, I can write you a check for $25,000 from the Stones account, but the Stones aren't going to authorize it. And then I can turn around and cancel the check anyhow. So they started screaming at me and basically said, but I was crazy. And they went off to torment two other people.
Chip felt he had a duty to try to apologize to Meredith's mother.
It took me about 2.5 years to get an apology to Mrs. Hunter. Nobody tried to apologize to her. The Stones left for the UK, and we didn't have any place to run. And I thought it might be a good idea that some way, something ought to be said to her.
The Hells Angels were heavily criticized for their actions, and when they heard that Meredith Hunter's death had been captured on film, they wanted to see it, and they ordered a meeting with Sam.
Well, it's very heavy. They wanted to see someone from the Stones, and I went, and yeah, it was scary, probably the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. But well, I think they were amazed that I had the front to show up. They wanted to get the film. They knew it had been filmed and they knew that the killing was on film. So they knew that the police would get that and that was the evidence. So they wanted to see what the evidence was. I didn't have the film, but I did call some people and help them get it and see it.
Albert Mazels.
They demanded $1 million for the being in the film because they consider themselves, if they called it, life actors.
I think we've got one of the Hell's Angels on the line, Sonny Barger.
I didn't go there to police nothing, man. I ain't no cop, and this Mick Jagger put it all on the Angels, man. Like, he used us for dupes, man. You know, and as far as I'm concerned, we were the biggest suckers for that idiot that I can ever see. And you can call them people flower children and this and that. Some of them people was loaded on some drugs that it's just too bad we wasn't loaded on, because they come running off of the hill yelling, ah, you know, and jump on somebody, and it wasn't even always jumping on Angels, but when they jumped on an Angel, they got hurt.
Keith Richards.
Somebody knocked their bikes over, and the next minute this black kid got scared, pulls a gun, and they did him. Yeah, if you pull a gun, well, you're asking if you don't, you know, you don't pull a gun and not use it. You know, it's like the kid was scared, you know. But they did it.
In the court case that followed, no one was convicted of any crime, and after 40 years, confusion still shrouds the circumstances of Meredith Hunter's death.
so many people in the press have misrepresented what was going on by calling it a murder. It's still not clear exactly what the motivation was. We do know even from the film that there were several shots that were fired by Meredith Hunter. The Hell's Angels could well have been protecting Mick and other people by his act of killing.
Mick Jagger.
I couldn't actually see anything at Altamont. I never saw the incident with the guy with the gun and the knife. I mean, you couldn't see anything. One tends to see, you see nothing. You get light in your eyes and so on. But that was scary. I mean, that was seriously scary.
Despite all the drama and death, that 1969 tour is still important for one thing, the Rolling Stones' music.
Every time I would see the Stones, it was great. Every time it was a different show. Every time it was a different reaction. It was fantastic to listen to the music. When Satisfaction would come on and the fans go crazy. When Midnight Rambler, when Mick would lay on the stage and whip the stage and pull off his belt. Those were the amazing moments. All the other stuff, death and crap, it's part of growing up.
It defined or helped to define and focus what rock tours would be and become. I think it was a massive tour musically for the Rolling Stones. I mean, if you listen to it, they were at the peak of their powers.
Shedding Hippie Blood is a 10-ounce production for BBC Radio 2.